Welcome into another edition of the Dane and Victory podcast, only available on musketeerreport.com. I am Rick. I am joined by the legend Brian Snow, and Dan is also on the line as well. Gentlemen, it's been a while since we've all gathered to have a conversation, and so a few things have happened since then with Xavier's roster. Obviously, I think the last time we talked, Mackinday London had just transferred, or at least we found out that he was going to transfer. But since then, Larry Austin also decided to transfer. We know that he went to Vanderbilt now. And Trayvon Blewett has returned from the draft as expected. Jalen Reynolds hired an agent. So kind of, I think, mostly what we expected, although the Mackinday and Larry situations were just a little interesting because after the season ended, they had their end of the year meetings. Everyone said they were coming back, which I think me and Brian were totally surprised by at first. And then as it played out, the guys you kind of would have expected would want to leave did decide to leave.
I'm going to say this though. I know we talked a little bit about Mackinday the last time, but to me, like, Larry Austin electing to leave at this point in his career makes sense to me because I think he could look at who's on the roster right now and who's coming down the pike and probably think to himself, you know, I'm probably never going to be entrusted with running this team. And because he's a non-shooter, he doesn't really fit with the kind of the style that Chris seems to want to play. So Larry deciding to leave at this point with 2 years of eligibility left, that made some sense. And obviously he landed at a place that I think is a better, like a more high profile program than I think any of us really thought.
But that's the interesting part to me. Like in his case, I mean, I know everyone is confident in themselves and everything, but in his case, if he was looking, he left Xavier because assumedly he wanted a bigger role and he wanted to do more. I was a little surprised he chose a place like Vanderbilt where, to be quite honest, Vanderbilt's going to have to recruit over him too if Bryce Drew wants to keep his job.
I'm honestly stunned Vanderbilt took him. There's 2 years of tape. I mean, I don't know what tape they were looking at, but good for Larry. I mean, is what it is. I was just very surprised that Vanderbilt took him, and I was surprised Larry went there.
Going
back to the bigger, so from a basketball perspective, you know, for Larry, it made sense for him to leave Xavier. But for Mackinday, I still am a little bit confused as to why that went down. I mean, just given his situation, given the fact that he will lose a year of eligibility as a result of this, and that he did show flashes this year of potentially having a bigger role on the team, and with a situation where Xavier, frankly, you look forward, you game this out over the next two seasons, and, you know, there's not a whole lot of, like guys that you write in pen in terms of getting big minutes at bigs over the next 2 years. I mean, this year they'll have Rasheed Gaston and Sean O'Mara. You don't know how much Eki Ori will play. You don't know Tyree Jones, maybe even a red shirt. It seems like there were potentially some openings for minutes there. And then the next year, you know, Gaston will be gone. O'Mara will be a senior, but you'll have Jones and Eki Ori around, and then whoever they recruit. But it seems like Mackinday would have been in the mix for that. So giving up a year of eligibility, dropping down a level, that one surprised me. I was surprised Mackinday elected to go. It doesn't make as little sense as it would have made if Sean O'Mara transferred, which was heavily rumored. But that one I expected, but I was still a little bit surprised that he elected to make that decision.
Yeah, I think especially after the meetings, when they went through the meetings and he didn't say anything about transferring and was just like asking what he needed to do, it surprised me a little bit that it didn't even come up. But that being said, I think one of the things for Mackinday was, I think the biggest thing for Mackinday was the fact that Xavier had just brought in two forwards, you know, two big men right in this class in Eki Ori and Tyreek Jones right behind him. I think that was probably, he had to look at that and probably had people in his ear telling him, like, you got to realize the situation here. Like, they're kind of recruiting over you. And whether that was the case or not, it certainly looks that way from an optics standpoint. So I could see why he felt like he might not get a chance at X. But at the same time, like you said, if you're going to give up a year of eligibility anyways, like his senior year, he would have a really good chance to play at X almost regardless of what happens. So it was I think it was a questionable decision, but at the same time, in terms of basketball, but at the same time, I'll never question a kid who, you know, makes a decision like that, especially when you're transferring down a level to somewhere where you know you're going to get a chance to play and be featured in the offense. That makes more sense to me, quite honestly, than Larry going to Vanderbilt.
Yeah, I mean, to me, the whole theme of this offseason is everything we really expected to happen happened just in the most odd way possible. Like, we all expected Jalen to leave, and then there was like that sliver of, well, maybe he's not. Then you expected Trayvon to come back, and even though it was never real, some people thought, eh, maybe he isn't. And then, you know, Sean, you're like, oh, Sean's going to stay. Everyone's leaving in front of him. And then Sean talks about leaving. He comes back. And then obviously the two transfers who both said they were staying, and it's like, well, I thought they were going to leave. So everything worked out the way expected, just in an unexpected way.
That's a good way to sum up, Snow. You've been watching a lot of First Take or something, because you really delivered your thesis there at the end in a strong fashion.
It's what I do. I'm a genius.
I guess with Bayless going to Fox Sports, you know, there is an opening.
I'll take it.
That would be interesting television. Stephen A. Smith and the legend Brian Snow. Next on First Take. All right. So just looking at this roster that Xavier has coming back, I mean, I don't think a lot has changed in terms of the guys that we know are going to be the main guys for next year. But you did lose maybe a little bit of depth. To me, I don't think it really affects much. Like, quite honestly, I don't think they needed a guy like McKinde. It would have maybe been an interesting luxury if he could have found a stroke from the outside to where he could have given you something offensively. But Xavier needs toughness and athleticism and rebounding and defense out of their post guy. And so I think Tyreek Jones or Eddie Ekior probably had a better chance to take on some of those extra minutes that Rashid Gaston and Sean O'Mara aren't going to take. So, I don't know. Do you guys have any thoughts on what this does to the roster, or anything else about the returning roster, anything on Trayvon?
It's obviously a very, very good roster, but it's a roster with very little margin for error. But the thing is, if you're going to accomplish what you want to accomplish, losing McKinde, London, and Larry Austin doesn't get in the way of that. Those guys aren't getting you to the Final Four. They're just not. So this roster is going to live and die with those top 8-9 guys, and whoever was behind them, really, I don't want to minimize them, but it's irrelevant. Those 8-9 are going to play. They're going to play all the minutes. You can survive one injury. You can't survive two. But realistically, nothing changed by the transfer. So I think this is the roster. This is the caliber of roster that Xavier wanted, that Xavier needed, and it's a top 10 caliber roster.
Yeah, I'd agree with that, Rick, and Snow. And the other thing that I would mention is that, as Brian just said, there's not really like – it's not like losing either of these two guys creates a situation where you're particularly thin at any one position. Because, you know, point guard, you've got Ed, you've got Quentin, you've got Miles Davis who can play there. McKinde, you know, if you consider him a four, you've got all the wing guys that play the three, the four. If you consider McKinde as potentially playing the five, you've obviously got a number of guys who can play that position. So it's not like losing Larry or McKinde puts you in a spot where we're one injury away from really having to jury rig a lineup. I think that they've got it that both of those guys were to a certain extent luxury items. Obviously, McKinde London makes huge strides this offseason and shows up for camp and is a different player and is more consistent in showing what, you know, he's shown in glimpses over the last 2 years and in practice, then that would have been a big deal for Xavier, but he wasn't a guy they were going to depend on anyway. So I think the biggest thing obviously is Trayvon Blewett coming back. And the thing that we know about Trayvon, just based on him going through this process, is he's going to be super motivated. The view is, as Brian put forth on the board, that this is almost certainly going to be his last season at college ball. So you know he's going to be super motivated. This is going to be really a business-like period where he's going to be viewing these next 12 months as an extended job interview. And so you would certainly expect him to be completely on point with his preparation, with his with getting his body in shape, with being ready to roll once the season starts. So that's the biggest, that obviously was the biggest thing this offseason to me. And I think another thing that's good for Xavier is that some of their biggest competitors in the league, not Villanova necessarily, but some of the biggest competitors around them in the league have had really damaging losses to the NBA draft. So I think I think Xavier's actually come out kind of ahead out of this offseason, all things considered.
The thing you mentioned about Trayvon, I think that's a good point, Dan, and that's exactly why the staff wanted, like, made him do his dad really wanted him to do this, and the staff basically told him, like, look, you need to declare for the NBA right now, and that was the reason why, because the last thing you want is this sort of question looming over, like, oh, I'm not getting the NBA looks that I should have gotten, or maybe I should have gone, or you're not using me the right way now, or any of that stuff. You don't want any doubt there this season. What they did is say, go there, let them, you know, don't get invited to the combine. Obviously, that wasn't what they wanted, but that's how it played out. Get feedback from the coaches. Let them tell you that you're not ready yet and exactly what you need to work on, and then come back completely motivated, knowing what you need to do and focused for the next season, and have no doubt that you weren't good enough to go to the NBA right now. You need a great year. And I think that's exactly how it played out. And like you said, he should be firing on all cylinders when the season rolls around in November. All right, one other thing there on kind of guys from last year. You know, we mentioned Jalen hiring an agent. He's in the process now. He had to finish up graduating, made sure he took care of the books. But now, you know, he's worked out for the Mavericks. Today he worked out, we're recording this on Wednesday night, so today he worked out for the Wizards, and he will be working out for the Bulls tomorrow. Now, one of the things, not a ton of feedback, specific stuff that I've heard yet about his workouts, but the one thing that I did hear after his Mavericks workout was that they were impressed with the way he shot the ball, and he was hitting some NBA threes, shooting it pretty well from mid-range, from what I understand in his workout, and that's something where, you know, all these NBA guys have scoured over every second of synergy film that's out there on these guys from their college days. And that's something that Jalen just wasn't able to showcase while he was at Xavier, is his ability to shoot. We know he has some touch. No one really wanted him showing it off for Xavier. But if he is able to really impress with his jump shot in workouts, and then he goes and does that in the summer league, and then maybe does it in the D league for a little bit, that is, I do think he has a little bit of a chance to gain some intrigue from NBA teams if he shows that he has a little bit more of a face-up game. So what I'm all in on right now is getting Jalen onto a team for the summer league, and then just hoping we get to watch Devereaux's League Jalen in the NBA summer league. Because if he does that, I mean, he might get a max deal next year or something.
Yeah, I mean, I will say, I think with Jalen, at the end of his sophomore year, if you go back and watch, he was hitting a lot of those mid-range jumpers. When him and Matt were playing together, he I don't want to say it was like a normal thing, but he took and he made, at least my memory serves, a decent amount of them. Last year, he just had no concept when he was away from the rim of how to finish. That was weird. But, yeah, I mean, Devereaux's Jalen is maybe the greatest basketball player in the history of basketball, and we would all be honored to see that on a national stage.
And one other interesting note from the Wizards workout today, he was in there with Octavius Ellis, and I'm told they, you know, clean, but they were competing and having a good time, sharing a few laughs with the NBA guys, where, you know, tell them not to get too close to each other and to calm it down a little bit when elbows got too high and things of that nature. So sounded like, you know, so far he's enjoying the process.
Is that just them having like a sense of humor, like when they had Stainbrook
and Josh Smith
workout at the Lakers last year?
I would pay money for video of that workout. I'd go at least $5.99 for the download.
I'd like to see the two of them demolish the spread after the game too.
Oh yeah, the buffet table, like that they set out. You know, like there's some bagels on the end, and then there's the donuts and stuff for like the staff at another table. They just passed up like the bagel and banana table. It went straight to the donuts and pizza that was there for the workers. No question in my mind.
Just Discovery Channel level stuff on that one. Just annihilation.
So can we – so Snow, can you – Snow or Rick, whichever one is better positioned, can you just walk us through, I guess, because it's come out a bit piecemeal, but who are the big – like what are the big decisions that have been made from prominent players in the Big East? Like who's gone from the prominent Big East teams this offseason?
Isaiah Whitehead and Ben Bentile are kind of the main two. I think everyone else came back.
Yeah, I mean, I think the team that's going to be affected the most is obviously Providence. You lost Chris Dunn, which you obviously knew, and Bentile's gone as well. They went from being a team that was, you know, with Bentile coming back, they're maybe, you know, top six, maybe top seven teams, maybe even battling for that fifth or fourth spot. Without him, I just don't see how they're even really that competitive this year in the Big East.
Yeah, I see them at ninth.
And then obviously Ellington leaving, but we all knew that was going to happen.
I mean, 10, it was a tough one, but I guess I'll go with the Fighting Brorings at 10.
It's a bad choice, man. It's a bad choice. I think this is the year for Billy Garrett and Tommy Hamilton. I think they're going to figure it out finally.
Are they both still there?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Like, we need to find a way to get to Val Ackerman and find a way to make sure Xavier is playing on senior night at DePaul just for you.
I would go. I would find a way down there. Isaiah Whitehead, that was an interesting one. There were conflicting reports out there. Him leaving Seton Hall it certainly changes things for them. Snow, how big of a drop is that for Seton Hall in your opinion? I think there's still a team that can be competitive, but I think, to me, they went from like maybe that second tier of teams to probably more in like that third tier of teams that's all bunched up.
I don't know how many tiers we're talking.
Well, it seems like you always have like two or three teams at the top that are clearly better, and then you have pretty much everyone else in the middle right there that's played out the last few years, where like third through sixth or seventh can't be figured out, and then after that you have the kind of the bottom half or the bottom third of the league. And I kind of think they're probably in that group now.
Yeah, I mean, I would put them through fourth through sixth, personally, four, five, six, that range. I think Villanova's one, Xavier's two, and Creighton's three. It was going to be a big four if Whitehead came back, but now I think they're more on par with St. John's, with maybe even Butler, with Marquette, and just kind of – Georgetown, because somehow Georgetown got another year of eligibility for Bradley Hayes and no one quite figures out how. But, you know, there's a lot returning, so I think Seton Hall's in that mix, which would be the, you know, 20 to 50 in the country type mix.
See, I've got them. I don't know. Kidding Carrington, Desi Rodriguez, Angel Degado, that's a pretty good trio right there. It'll be interesting to see what they can put around them and some of the young guys that they've got and what that means for them. So I don't know.
Miles Powell's a really good piece.
Yeah, you can
especially
really
around those guys. Ishmael Sonogo's a good player. He really is. I mean, he's a perfect fourth, fifth guy because he never needs the ball. He's going to defend. He's going to do what you want. I think they're a little bit better than you do.
All right. Well, how do you feel about the Fighting Andrew Rouseys of Marquette?
I just don't know what the heck they're going to do at the power forward position. I mean, they have everything else. But, man, trying to figure out what – I mean, you talk about playing small ball. They're going to be playing extraordinarily small ball right now. So that'll be interesting. I don't know if they'll be able to keep teams off the glass a whole lot. But they're going to make threes. They're going to take a lot of threes. They're going to have a lot of options in the backcourt, especially adding Caden Reinhart and Rousey and Marcus Howard. I think they're a team that has potential because they're going to be able to score.
Yeah,
I mean, they're going to be playing a completely different system this year. It's not going to look anything like them last year.
Yeah.
I think the only other kind of notable staying or going storyline was Josh Hart, which I thought there after they won it, there might be a chance he would leave. He is returning to Villanova. So to me, I think they're the clear-cut number one. I think you guys all agree with that.
Yeah, and I would put them number – I think they're better in Kentucky. I'd put them number two in the country.
Yeah, I mean, very difficult for me to see how they don't come into this year, you know, on the Vegas odds, like the third or fourth lowest odds of any team to win the title this year. I mean, they, obviously, losing Archie Diacono, a lot of people will say, well, I mean – But I mean, can Jalen Brunson, it seems to me, can do everything Archie Diacono can do. Maybe not. Maybe he doesn't bring as many lunch pails to work. Maybe his hard hat isn't quite as scarred. But I mean, Brunson's a hell of a point guard, and they've got so much talent. And we saw some of their young talent work into the rotation last year, especially in the back half of the season, and make huge strides, make huge contributions for them down the stretch. I mean, they've got everything. So yeah, Nova's a, you know, 2, 3, 4 in the country going into the season. It would seem to me.
You bring up the national rankings. There's all types of early, and I like preseason rankings, but at this time of the year, I just haven't even started really paying attention to them all that much, at least for the whole country. Xavier's been kind of everywhere. You've seen him as high as top five, seen him in the top 25. I think they've even been left out of a few polls. Snow, what do you think? Where are you comfortable putting Xavier at?
Anywhere between about 8 and 15. I think, you know, you can quibble with one or two spots here and there. I think I personally have him 10. But I think anything lower than 15 is absolutely absurd. I mean, you return near four leading scorers on a team that won, what, 25 games or whatever, and was a 2 seed. I mean, I think people overrate. Jalen and James were good. They were very good. I think people overrate just how good they really were and how replaceable. How, you know, it's like Rashid Gaston's this, like, mythological figure to a lot of national people. Like, the odds that Rashid Gaston won't give you the numbers Jalen Reynolds gave you is very small. I think he's going to give Jalen Reynolds numbers at minimum. Sean O'Mara is the best low post scorer on the team. I think they're just fine in that regard.
Yeah, and I think that's why, you know, the staff was really so, you know, willing to tell Jalen, hey, you should probably go make some money. I don't think they were worried about losing Jalen because, quite honestly, at this point, he hasn't figured it out. He hasn't reached his potential. I mean, he's a really solid college player, but I don't think he was ever going to take that next step and be this all-world guy that a lot of people thought he could potentially be. And because of that, you're right. I mean, what do you have to replace? 9-7, 10-7, whatever it was, 10-6, something like that. I think Rashid will be a more locked-in defender, a more conscientious defender. And in terms of strength and toughness and all that, that's Rashid's game. So essentially, he's going to be able to replace what Jalen does. Will he have quite the highlight reel dunks that Jalen did? No, maybe not. And can he do the Devereaux Summer League performances that Jalen could, where he's handling the ball like that? No, but those weren't functional things that actually translated to college games. So in terms of what you lost with Jalen, I agree with you. I don't think they'll have any trouble replacing that. And I honestly think they could get more offense out of the post this year if Sean O'Mara is playing 20 minutes, because he's a guy that, with his back to the basket, has a lot of game, has, you know, a different moves and counter moves, which, quite honestly, Jalen and James both had a jump hook in the post.
Yeah.
I mean, that was it. They, you know, both of them were more comfortable facing the basket and making a one or two dribble, or James shooting and Jalen making a one or two dribble move to the rim. So, yeah, I completely agree with that take.
Yeah, the post situation, these guys have completely, it's almost like the opposite skill set as James and Jalen. So it'll be kind of, I think it's going to be an adjustment a little bit, but you kind of wonder if that will open up a little bit more space for the perimeter guys who are going to be expected to do the bulk of the scoring.
If we're being honest, too, that's part of why, like, the production isn't that absurd that you have to replace, because this team, the way they play on offense, just doesn't really rely on the post being their go-to guy. I mean, you know, when Matt Stainbrook was here, it was. But last year, we saw the way they wanted to play with Trayvon kind of being their feature scorer. They spread it out. He plays the four. They go small ball. They move it. They pass it. They shoot jump shots. Ed gets into the lane and gets the rim. Quentin's going to do those same types of things. T- to me, I just don't think they're going to look, with the personnel they have right now, they're going to look at their post guys to be focal points of the offense. Now, Sean may get a few more touches in there, but I just don't think that's something that is a big concern, because it's just not how they're going to play for at least this coming season.
So yeah, I guess the last Xavier topic would be the schedule. Two podcasts ago, Rick, you talked to Mario. It was right after the Gavitt Games situation had taken place. Obviously, there's been a lot of wheeling and dealing in the interim. The way it's come out is that Xavier had two empty slots on their schedule. They've actually expanded that to three by including a non-bracketed game at home against Northern Iowa. They'll play Utah at home, and they'll travel to Waco, Texas, to take on the smoking ruins of Baylor University. What'd you guys think of that? I mean, it seemed to me that was about the best that Mario kind of did a nice job of putting that together with duct tape at the last minute, and it seems like that non-conference schedule is instead of being a liability for the team, it may be even a strength now with the addition of those three games.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing that's missing is you don't have, once again, this team's goal is to be a number one seed. They don't have that, like, marquee, like, top five win that they can get on the schedule. So it does miss that, and maybe theoretically, if it was Wisconsin or Indiana, you could have gotten that extra top 10 caliber win in the non-conference. So you're going to miss that. But outside of that, I mean, I think the overall non-conference strength of schedule number is going to be impressive.
Yeah, I think they did an incredible job. And quite honestly, it probably, in terms of strength of schedule, it probably worked out better.
No question.
They did. I agree with you. What you said, Snow. It doesn't quite have the same optics of, you know, you get a shot at against Wisconsin at home, especially after last year.
Right.
That game would have had a ton of focus on it. One thing I would like to add is when we had, or not, we didn't have him on the podcast, but I talked to Mario and wrote something about this when we all found out about the Gavitt game mess, and he was telling us, you know, basically no stone will be unturned type of deal. They're going to try everything and look at everything. And I don't know, like, where we're at in terms of what can be put out there or not. We'll have Mario on a podcast soon to talk about it all. But let me just be clear that they absolutely looked at every scenario. I mean, wrote contracts up in some situations with some crazy ideas. There was a lot of wheeling and dealing going on before they got to this point, and they really did try everything and got pretty creative. And obviously, going to the exempt event, getting an extra game there against Northern Iowa, that was a very creative move, and having to make that return game next year. But just a pretty impressive job. And that's, you know, we always talk about, we don't really question Mario at this point with the scheduling. And that's exactly why, because he did a phenomenal job of getting them into taking a terrible situation basically with the schedule and turning it into a pretty good one.
Rick, yeah. One quick correction. They did leave one stone unturned. And that was a series with Dayton. That was not going to happen.
Correct. Yes, that is true.
All right. So I guess I don't have any other Xavier topics. Yeah, we were going to talk about one thing, which was the possibility of additions to the roster coming up. Xavier now involved pretty heavily with a transfer from Kentucky. Rick, you put something out there on the message board just today.
Yeah, and it was something I was kind of sitting on for the last couple days, because I was trying to do a Nuggets post and I was waiting on a few other things to come in, and then obviously it gets put out there, so that's why you don't do that. But Charles Matthews, I wrote a big post about him today on the board. 6'6", long, athletic. Snow can probably tell you even a little bit more about what went into the rankings, because he was a 5-star at one point, ended up being 80th in the country, a 4-star. But I think, to me, this guy is a no-brainer type of guy. And we just didn't think that Xavier was necessarily going to be that active in his recruitment the second time around with the transfer. It's not like they were one of the finalists the first time around. But Luke Murray has them in there. It's them in Michigan from what I'm hearing, and it sounds like it's pretty much down to those two schools. I'm expecting a visit for each school. I'll visit Michigan first later this month, and Xavier as well this month. And at that after that point, I mean, it's a transfer situation. I think it's going to move pretty quickly. I wouldn't be surprised to see something happen on those visits or shortly thereafter. It's going to be really interesting to see how this one plays out. But from what I understand, you know, the other schools that have been mentioned, Michigan State, Oregon, Illinois, teams that were in there the first time around, not really involved at this point. It's pretty much down to Xavier and Michigan. Snow, can you give us a little more insight on kind of what happened there after his going into a senior year when he dropped in the rankings and all that?
Yeah, you know, we saw this kid a ton, and early on he had a lot of hype, and he was pretty darn good. And you're looking at a kid who was probably at the time 6'4", 6'5", could play some point guard, was long, was a good athlete. And you kind of always said, man, his potential's huge. He was decently productive, but he never really started producing consistently. And when you're doing this, you hang on, and then it's like at some point in time, we just can't keep this kid in the top 30 anymore. And we decided, you know, just outside of the top 75 was kind of the way to go with Charles. And that doesn't mean he's a bad player, obviously. I mean, it means we think he's a really good player, which is we didn't think he was an NBA player at the end. So that's really what happened there. But I think what's important to know about this is the staff's going on the assumption that Edmund Sumner and Trayvon Blewett are leaving after this year. You combine that with Miles Davis obviously completing his graduation this year, which means for three and a half perimeter spots, they're only going to have two guys who have ever played a minute of college basketball. So they kind of want another older guy as opposed to just bringing in five freshmen, if you could even get five freshmen to play on the perimeter. So I think that's kind of what the theory is we want a guy with some experience.
Yeah, from everything I've heard, I don't think this was a situation where UK people were like, oh, yeah, that dude needs to leave. I think pretty much everyone at UK thought like, oh, he'll be a solid guy that sticks around here for 3 or 4 years. But clearly, with the way they recruit, that puts you in a position where you may never be a main contributor on the team. So it's understandable that he wanted to look elsewhere, but I don't think this was a situation where it's like, oh, this guy can't play here.
When it's a you get forced out situation, that happens right away, not in mid-May.
Right.
So he wasn't forced out of UK by any stretch.
Yeah, so you agree this is a no – I mean, I've said it on the message board, but you agree this is a no-brainer for X. If they can get him, you got to go.
The concern for me is, you know, he was 1-for-4 from three this year. You're Xavier, you're looking at your top targets, Paul Scruggs, Najee Marshall – Nojel Eastern, Greg Elliott, you know, go down the line, you're looking at being somewhat of a non-shooting team. So that would be my concern.
Yeah, I'm looking back at his shooting when he was – his final year of AAU, he shot it decently well. Struggled a little bit at Peach Jam, but shot it really well in the EYBL before Peach Jam that year. Do you think, you know, there's more than what he saw in his limited minutes at UK last year as a shooter, or do you think he's probably not going to be an outside shooter?
I think at least early on, you know, maybe by the time he's a fifth-year senior or whatever, he might be fairly reliable, maybe a D. Davis career arc for shooting. But – I would be surprised if he was a above average shooter, at least to start his career.
All right. What else do we any other Xavier topics you want to talk about, Rick? Any recruiting updates, or are we pretty much where we were last week when you guys did the recruiting roundup?
Yeah, Snow and I have hit it so hard on the last two podcasts that we recorded. We're just straight recruiting. Obviously, we're posting stuff on the board in between there as well. So you guys are all caught up to date. You can kind of go there and read anything. The only little kind of new tidbit is that I think, you know, Jericho Sims, one of the only big man that I had on the hot board, one of the few big men that Xavier is recruiting. I think we've heard recently that the staff feels they're in a pretty good position with him. So a little bit of an update there. That's kind of the spot they're in with a lot of those guys that are at the top of their list right now. But at this point, it's you know, best you can hope for is being in a really good spot. So that's where they're at with him and several other guys, and any other updates we'll have on the board for you. So, Dan, let's get to your off-the-topic questions here.
So here's my I'm going to preface this. This is a great question for Snow because I feel like Snow can give us, like, some good insider insight into this. But I'm reading an article the other day about our national nervous breakdown known as the presidential election, and they talked about the fact that the two presumptive candidates have, like, the most ridiculously low approval ratings of major candidates in the modern era or something like that. It's not really important how what those are. But so it got me to thinking, like, about approval ratings for major college basketball coaches and, like, who would have the highest and lowest approval ratings, like, if you just looked at their fan base, like, college basketball fans as a whole and among the coaching fraternity. So I figured we could maybe take those three separately. So, Rick, you tell me. So Rick and I talked about this a little bit on text the other night, so I think we've got
start with Snow. I want to hear his answers.
Okay, so Snow, if we're talking only about if you could take a poll of each fan's – of each major college's fan base and it was like approval rating of your coach – who do you think would have the highest approval rating among their own fans in the country?
Krzyzewski.
Really? I would have thought Calipari.
No, because those crazy bastards. Are you kidding me?
I mean, they pretty much love their own no matter what. Like, there's some, I guess there's some that question the one-and-done stuff. But for the most part, he's pretty well.
The top two are Krzyzewski and Jay Wright. I don't even think that's in question.
Jay Wright's an interesting one.
Yeah, that is a good one. I actually had Jay as an answer for one of the later questions. But okay, Snow, so you got Krzyzewski on this one. Rick and I had Cal. Okay, lowest. So we're talking major colleges. So, you know, figure your whatever top six conferences, top seven conferences. Which coach currently would have the lowest approval rating among their own fan base?
I think Steve Alford would probably be number one. And then maybe John Gross, number two.
Wow. Okay, those are two good ones. I had said John Thompson the third just because of Georgetown's constant underachieving and frequent first-round meltdowns in the tournament. But I don't know if that's – I don't really know if that's true or not. I don't really know that many Georgetown fans. I just know that if that was the status of Xavier, the natives would be restless. Rick, what do you think?
Well, let me add, I don't necessarily have a better one than you guys do here, but I am interested. Where are things with Tom Crean and the Indiana fan base, Snow? Has he kind of won them back over? Are they good with him?
I mean, I don't know if I'm going to say he's won him over, but he's not at, like, seat is melting your butt level. You know, it's a little toasty there. But it's not an extreme. You have extreme opinions, but as an overall whole, I think it's, you know, slightly below average approval rating.
Okay. I think the John Thompson one's good too. I like that one, Dan. That's a nice take.
So those we're just sort of rating on what we think it is, but who should have, let's say, who do you think is underrated by their fan base in the country?
Underrated by their fan base.
Yeah, they take a little bit more crap than maybe they deserve.
Ooh, wait a minute. Ooh, I want to amend my highest approval rating to Tom Izzo. He has a 100% approval rating.
For Michigan State fans.
Yeah, and lowest approval rating is Richard Pitino, because anytime there's a newspaper article about the head coach of a major team not filling up his rental car gas tank, that means people are out to get him.
True. That's a really good point. He's got to be way down there on that list.
I have a feeling that won't be the last time a Pitino is mentioned as having a low approval rating. Just a spoiler alert. All right, moving on. So let's talk about college basketball fans as a whole. So every fan base, even, you know, the crazy ones, the intelligent ones all over the country, what coach do you think nationwide has the highest approval rating? Rick, we'll start with you this time.
It's got to be Coach K or Izzo, right? It probably Izzo, because I think there's enough people that hate Duke more so than they hate Michigan State. So I think it's got to be Izzo.
Yeah, I'm with you there.
And I had, like, Izzo too. I think Izzo's
the best with the media, so the media – and I love Tom Izzo. I'm scared to death of the man, but I love him. But, like, he's unbelievable with the media, so the media is going to give him, like, the complete blowhard treatment. They're just going to – anything he says, oh, Tom, you're the greatest. So he gets that treatment from the media.
I think part of it is that he just is he's not really in any way a polarizing character. I mean, he's great with the media. His teams are always, like, really good, and they always have, like, a pretty strong identity. You know, this year is a rarity that they blew up in the tournament. Usually they survive a couple rounds further than you might expect them to, except when you expect them to win the title. There's just not really that much hatred out there for Michigan State as a program. You know, it's not like they're not as polarizing as a Duke or a Kentucky. So I've got Izzo on that one. Fans across college basketball, lowest approval rating.
Calipari has to be way up there.
I think Crean's
way up there on that one too.
Definitely.
I got Rick Pitino here. Because the Kentucky people all despise him.
And they're half the college basketball fans in the country. Yeah, that's a good point.
Pretty much, yeah. All the Duke people hate him from back when Duke and Kentucky was a big rivalry. And with the prostitution gate, the Italian restaurant situation, he just is kind of this sort of slimy ooze about him, and I just think that most people kind of just view him as a kind of a sleazy character and don't really care for him.
Yeah, I think if you go back before any of those incidents, though, no one says this at all. But I think you're reasonable after those two incidents. I think he is kind of viewed that way on a national level.
Yeah, I mean, I think he'd certainly be up there. I think Calipari's obviously number one. That man is despised. I mean, he's everything that's wrong with college hoops. Like, a kid transfers from South Dakota Tech, and it's John Calipari's fault. I mean, it's just – I don't even understand it.
It is a bizarre, like, how he gets blamed for everything. It's weird. But that being said, I don't think he goes out of his way to make friends.
Yeah, and in fairness, though, he thrives on that. I mean, I was listening to – I can't remember who the sports writer was. It was Dan Walken or one of those guys who covered him at UMass. And he talked about how Calipari, from his first coaching job, it was always about, like, developing this sort of obsession with whoever the big dog was and just needling. And for him then, it was Temple or Connecticut. And he'd always be like, what'd Calhoun say? What'd Cheney say? It was always kind of – so I think he thrives on that kind of – that edge on having a lot of people that just hate him. I mean, he was that way with Huggins when he was at Memphis. He's been that way throughout his whole career. So I think he loves, you know, being the villain for a decent percentage of the country. But I don't think Calipari can have the lowest approval rating because, like, 55% of college basketball fans root for Kentucky as far as I go.
That's a good point. I'll say I think he's probably got, like – he's got to be up there on the most hated by coaches list too.
Oh, yeah. Let's talk about that one. Who's the most hated coach in America, Snow?
By coaches.
By the coaching fraternity.
Man, I mean, Crean's certainly up there. Believe it or not, a lot of coaches dislike John Beilein.
Yeah, I've heard that too. That's kind of weird.
Why is that? Is that, I mean, without
he's,
without
he's a very in he's a different guy. Like, he doesn't one thing about coaches is, like, whoever's sitting next to Chris Mack, like, head coaches, like, they'll all sit together in the summer, like, let the peon assistants actually watch the game, and the head coaches will just talk ball. And, like, head coaches will, like, Chris Mack will be going over what they do in their 1-3-1, and, you know, it's – they'll share ideas. Beilein doesn't do that. So people kind of, like, take that the wrong way. Then the other thing is Beilein's, like, the head of the ethics committee, and he's very quick to tell everybody that he doesn't cheat and he does everything the right way, and that drives other coaches bonkers.
That's interesting. With Crean, I don't think anybody would really be surprised. He's just a complete lunatic and a crazy person. Anybody else that falls into that range that you can think of, Rick?
No, I think Crean's the one that I know the best. Like, I mean, I don't have the connections that Snow does to head coaches, but Crean is the one where it's pretty obvious that everyone dislikes him. And it, some of it's for the same reasons. The fact that he doesn't seem to want to sit in and talk shop. He's down there writing notes in his notebook the whole time he's watching kids. And he's always taking shots at everybody else for what they're doing wrong and, you know, throwing stones in glass houses type of situation, I think.
Bruce Pearl would be another one who's not going to win any homecoming votes.
Yeah, that's another one that kind of goes without saying, it seems like. So on the other side of the coin, who would be the most popular? Like, who's the most liked on the trail? And I'm curious if there are some guys that are maybe a little bit under the radar. Like, I know, is it Greg Campy at Oakland?
That's exactly really what I was well just liked. Going to say is Greg Campy.
Yeah, I mean, he's been there forever, and, you know, he's not a threat.
Yeah, everyone loves him. He tells wild stories. He looks like he just rolled out of bed when he shows up to AAU games. I mean, yeah, everyone's full of him.
Huggins is unbelievably popular with his peers.
That doesn't surprise me in the slightest bit.
People love Hugs.
Where's Frank Martin at on this list, like in the coaching fraternity? Liked, disliked, feared?
Oh, he's liked. Frank's definitely liked.
Okay. Yeah,
because, like, Frank's a scary individual, like, on TV, but, like, he's a great dude. Like, great dude. Rick Barnes is really liked by his colleagues. Except for Scott Drew. They don't really like each other.
Last time I saw Frank, it was at the EYBL event, but he had their Under Armour, right? Sponsored by Under Armour, and he had this, yeah, like, 3X all gray bowling type shirt where it's short sleeved and buttoned down, just way oversized, ill fitting, maybe the worst college basketball coach look other than Huggins when he's wearing a 4X West Virginia pullover that looks like it's from 1992 and jorts with an elastic waistband. He literally looks like he's in maternity clothes. So that was like a couple years ago when he was recruiting Devin Williams, but, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I would say those guys are pretty popular. Billy Donovan was really popular. Obviously, Billy has moved along. Sean Miller's pretty popular with his peers. So those would be some guys. I've never heard anyone say they dislike Lorenzo Romar.
That's an interesting one. Well, all right. So that was my hot take, Bates. No, you delivered.
All right. Do you want to do something quick on the finals here? You guys have some hot NBA finals takes here? Predictions?
I think this will be the highest rated NBA finals of the post-Jordan era. That'd be my first one. I think it's going to be incredible. I mean, anytime you have the two best players in the game playing each other, that's good. And I just think the matchups are so intriguing. Like, how's Cleveland going to use Kevin Love? You know, is LeBron going to be the five man half the time?
Yeah, will Kevin Love even play fourth quarters?
Yeah, I mean, there's just so much going on, because the thing that Golden State can do is they put Draymond at the five and no one can deal with it. Well, the Cavs have the one guy in the league who can deal with it and is much better at it. So I'll be interested to see if Golden State even tries to go to that lineup. You know, do you even try it? It'll be intriguing to see what the matchups are, how home court is controlled. Can Tristan Thompson actually catch a basketball? There's a lot going on.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that Golden State has had to deal with is they've obviously had a much tougher road to get here. First of all, with Curry's injury, that made them a little bit vulnerable. And then, you know, that Portland series, although they won it in five games, I mean, three or four of those games were extremely competitive and went right down to the wire. And then, obviously, the Oklahoma City series was Armageddon. I mean, that was one of the most intense, well-played, dramatic, non-final series I can remember in my, you know, 25-odd years of watching NBA playoff basketball. The only series I could think of that I felt like was better than that might have been that San Antonio-Miami seven-game series in the finals. And then Cleveland. With Cleveland, I think the most intriguing thing about them is that they are completely healthy, which last year obviously was not the case. They were playing with LeBron and four Matthew Dellavedovas for the entire NBA Finals and still were pretty competitive. So,
well, it's this interesting thing, though, because them being injured last year meant they had no choice but to just go defensive, try to lock down. You've got Shumpert on the court. You got Dellavedova, who are much better defenders than Kyrie and Love and the guys that are playing right now. And so you had no choice but to really slow it down, really – you know, play defensive basketball against the Warriors. It'll be interesting to see what they do this year with those guys healthy, because with Kyrie and Love, you have to play more up-tempo. You have to let them kind of do their thing where there's really no use in having them on the court. You got to let them play offense and try to score. I'm interested to see how the Cavs handle that with those guys, because in some ways I think not having two of their best players kind of forced them to play a style that was conducive to beating the Warriors last year and made it difficult on the Warriors and allowed them to take it into six games. So that, I think that is a little bit interesting about having those guys healthy.
All right, so what are your predictions, guys?
Hold on.
Can we discuss something philosophically here?
Yes.
Rick, you're from Latonia, but me and Dan were from Cincinnati. So we're genetically predisposed to hating anything Cleveland. But at the same time, I think we all like LeBron and really think he's unbelievable. There's a philosophical like thing in my head. How do I support anything from Cleveland yet not root against LeBron? I don't know what to do.
To me, it's not a problem.
Snow, what metropolitan area are the Golden State Warriors located in?
San Francisco, Oakland.
And what which football team ruined my childhood in 1988, Miami, Florida?
Well, it was in 1989 in Miami, Florida, but January 6th, I believe. But
the 1988 season.
Yeah, that would be the San Francisco 49ers.
And then in, 2012, what team did the Reds completely gag to with the best team that they've had since 1999?
I believe the Reds did not make the playoffs in 2012 because I've wiped that from my memory.
No, going all in on semantics just to ruin the podcast.
No, I've wiped that from my memory. I was not at three games in a row that the Reds lost. It just didn't happen. I don't even know who Hunter Pence is. I don't know.
So I have absolutely no issues rooting against a San Francisco Bay Area team and rooting for Cleveland, because the Cavs Cincinnati doesn't have an NBA team. So
yeah,
the Cavs, because they're from Cleveland, it doesn't carry the same like visceral disgust that if the Indians or who's the other team? The Browns.
They actually go by the Browns, yes.
Yeah, but I was just conceiving the idea of the Browns playing for a championship, and it just really was – I guess it made my brain switch off.
Yeah, like –
But do you not get a little joy out of, like, Cleveland suffering and, like, Cubs fans suffering? Because I know I do.
Well, yeah, it's funny. But my thing would be, yeah, one, we don't have an NBA team in this area, so it doesn't really bother me on that front at all. The Cavs, I've always kind of rooted for the Cavs, to be honest, even before LeBron. And number two, the Cavs are like the Greg Campy of professional sports. They're not a threat. Like, you don't really care because they're not a threat. So I can easily be convinced into liking a Cleveland professional sports team if they have LeBron. That's not a problem.
Okay.
That being said, I do think the Warriors will win.
See, I'm going Cleveland.
How many games?
Six.
I think we get seven. I think we get seven, and it'll be the Warriors.
I got Cleveland in seven.
Wow. So, you both going Cleveland. Look at you guys.
When the Warriors wrap up a four-game sweep early next week, we will we can answer for that on the board.
Over, under 1.5 testicles kicked by Draymond Green in the series.
Over. Way over.
I like that.
I think 3.5 has to be the over-under.
Fair enough. It's like a Jalen technical deal. I understand.
Yeah.
All right. So, you guys got anything else good, or is that it?
I got nothing.
I think we're good.
All right. Solid podcast. Good work, gentlemen. You've been listening to another edition of the Dana Victory Podcast, only available on MusketeerReport.com. For Dan and the legend Brian Snow, I'm Rick. Thanks for listening, everyone.